I wanted to say something about John's presentation. I loved it, but I'm John's friend. But I think it's important in churches to hear stories like John's. And I think it's helpful for church people to hear it. And I think it's helpful for people who don't go to church to hear it, to have an understanding of one of the things that I, as a pastor, have always seen is that the church from the outside looks very different from the church from the inside. And one of the things I've always been impressed with of John's story of church here is how, even though churches ostensibly have these doctrinal propositional walls, which I think are important, what goes on in terms of the people inside is a lot more complex, and it almost always is. So, and when I look at, you know, I was talking to Nate Heil over there, who is known. Sam isn't here tonight. And Sam, of course, is a Unitarian trying to live in a Trinitarian world. And Nate is a Universalist trying to live in more, you know, Anglican worlds. There's a lot of diversity going on in church now. And part of what you talked about in terms of loss of a center orientation means the rise of a lot of autodidacts are forcing churches to try to probably rebalance the four P's a little better, but we're not quite sure where all this is going. So it's, and for me, like somebody on the bus, he prefers to stay anonymous, but we were on the bus and he was like, "What if we were all in the same church, all of us on the bus who played paintball?" And I thought, "Oh, we couldn't even manage communion, buddy." So, but here we are in this space. Here we are having these conversations. And so when I think about John's story and when I think about your point of the new orientation and I think about this gathering and what our conversations are doing, I think in a small way, that is what we are pursuing. We are, amidst all of the history that we have, either of conflict or community, we are trying to reorient. And I think that's, as Sevilla named it, this little corner is about. We are working on orientation. And it's a big deal.
And if I can just echo that a little bit, because John, the truth be told, what I was trying to do after your presentation, we in Estuary, we struggle with giving a name to what's happening. We don't know what these mysterious processes are that make it so that people come together and find a shared voice, find the spirit in the room, keep coming back for more of the same. What is that about? We're not serving communion there. We're not, we're not serving sandwiches even. I mean, Marv brings cookies to our meetup all the time. But so there is a thing happening in an estuary context, and it is apparently it's a lot bigger than what's happening here in my church, because all these estuary leaders are all able to gather other groups of people and have meaningful conversation. Well, that is the shorthand way of saying something is happening. But I am pretty sure that if you were to think about it, you would have some other words for what is actually happening in these circles. And we're kind of, frankly, I am kind of eager to know what you see and what meaning you attribute to it and how you explain it from your point of view in language that perhaps we haven't quite attained to yet. What is actually going on in an estuary group? So that's kind of, I mean, in a way, I think that there might be some similarity to your circling, but it's not the same. There's something going on there.
Yeah, and dialectic into dialogos is not circling either. It's another thing.
Right.
Why do you do this double thing, dialectic? Because I always want to make a distinction between a practice like dialectic, or circling, or empathy circling, or estuary, and dialogos, which is a process that you can participate in. But if you think you can make dialogos, you've misunderstood it and won't experience it. So that's why I always do, and I think there are families of practices that get people into Logos. So I think my answer would be that what's going on is something like the affordance.
Your mic is not doing well.
Is it cutting out a lot?
Same thing again, yeah.
Just started cutting out?
And some feedback. So maybe turn it off. Something.
Call that puppy.
Technology is the god that limps.
Yeah, Hephaestus.
So what I think is going on is Dialogos, and then my answer to you is an answer where, like, you clarify things by contrast, right? Is what's in Dialogos above and beyond dialogue? And so I think there's a lot, after Socrates and release a video just on that topic. Why, and then I get other people like, why don't you just say dialogue? Because it's not dialogue, right? It's something very different. And so the answer would be the ways in which I think Dialogos is different from dialogue.
But we also recognize clearly that there is something happening in the room, in the space, that is more than just the dialogue among the people.
Well, that's exactly a feature of Dialogos.
Yeah, but I mean, can you
enunciate
a little bit about what we're actually experiencing that we don't even know about?
Sure.
Because we really want to know. We want to know what's going on in our estuaries.
Okay, well, I will give you my best theoretical reflections on that. And I don't think they're complete or exhaustive by any means. I'm very much a participant in this and trying to understand it. So I'm not just trying to understand it outside from as a scientist. I participated in one of your meetings.
I'm trying
to do a lot of participant observation, a lot of these. And I want to say something very carefully. Each one has something unique about it, right? And I'm not disrespecting that uniqueness, but as a scientist, I'm trying to find what's shared, okay? But for me, and this is why I use the word logos, what shows up in these is you get a flow state between people in which they are able to start to get emergent ideas, emergent reflections, emergent awareness, it's not just ideas, that they couldn't get to on their own.
Right.
And then that starts to feed back and it enhances how they're picking up on each other. And then those two things start to come together and it takes on a life of its own. It takes on a life of its own, and it starts leading everybody, into first an initial sense of connectedness interpersonally, and then what often emerges is people get a sense of the we space or the logos, and there's not just interpersonal intimacy, there's we, like there's like what you and I have been talking about with spirit, right? The Geist shows up. I'll use a German word because it sounds less religiously overtoned. And then what also is, and none of that is possible in dialogue, because dialogue, when I see people say they're in dialogue, it doesn't connote any of these things I'm talking about.
No.
And then there's a third move in which people, it's not a ladder, it's not like you leave the other two behind, they're nested. There's the interpersonal intimacy, and then there's the intimacy with the logos, or the Geist of the logos, and then there's intimacy through that. Because there's a sense of getting into, not communication, but communion, like this connectedness, intelligibility, affording thing. And people get a sense that they're now communing with the way in which intelligibility itself appears and what it's appearing from. And very often people from non-religious, sometimes even anti-religious backgrounds will start to use religious and spiritual language spontaneously to talk about the way those three are vibrating for them, vibrating between and all of that's happening. What's happening inside you is something, and I hope this doesn't weird some people out, something very analogous to what's going on in when the brain is on psychedelics. So when the brain is on psychedelics, what happens are usual pathways of connection are being shut down, especially the default mode that's very egocentric, right? And parts of the brain that normally aren't talking to each other start talking to each other very powerfully. I've done mushrooms and done things like that. No. I've done psychedelics. Yes, shocking. Long time ago. Right. So I make it because I want to make not only a functional argument, I want to make a phenomenological argument. And one of the things that struck me, and it's because of him, I was doing circling with Taylor and a bunch of other people, and it got to that place, and it felt exactly like that. It felt, and here's the hypothesis. Because I'm internalizing all of you very rapidly, and I'm sort of giving it, and all that multi-perspectival, and the fact that we're all decentering off of the default mode network, areas of my brain are being forced to talk to each other that normally don't talk to each other. And the brain is picking up on that and going, whatever you're doing, do more of this because it's getting that this new intra-connection is improving all of the interconnections, and that's what the brain is looking for. And so I've told you what I think is happening outside, between, and also what I think is happening within.
Thank you. Very coherent, and I appreciate it. It will give all of us a little bit of a sense when we do our mysterious, weird estuary stuff, what may actually be happening, and that it has some credibility in cognitive science.
It does.
And so that we're not just a cult or freaking out. There are people who warn their relatives and their friends, well, you come to this conference, but are you sure you are not falling into some kind of a cult? I've heard people say that in this room or out paintball.
The problem with the accusation of being in a cult is like the accusation of being boring. There's no defense. Because we do not have any established criteria. We throw this term pejoratively around, and I'm not authorizing cults. Right? But we throw the term around, and there's no defense because there is nothing, there's no conceptual clarity behind the accusation. There's just a pejorative projection. So if you say, no, it's not a cult because, you know, we're not sending money to anybody late at night. Well, that's not what I mean. Like, there's a nebulous definition. So my advice to you is, unless the police or the people in your group are worried about you being a cult, don't worry about it.
No, I agree. Thank you for clarifying that. This is fun.
Question or otherwise?
Can you comment on the connection between altar and tomb and how this might relate both to letting go and dying before you die?
Who's the question directed to?
I think you should start.
I should start between the altar and tomb. okay, so one of the things to understand that happened in the Christian tradition, which is very particular, and most people don't understand or don't see, is that in the Jewish tradition, the Holy of Holies is in the West. And so you can understand it like, right, the influence of the East, or the sunlight, or the sunrise, or you know, the glory of God coming up in the East, lands in the West. So, the Holy of Holies is like a receptacle. It's a right. It's the seat. It's the it's the seat that receives the glory of God. And outside of the, so you have the, right, so you have the seat that receives the glory of God, and then out in the eastern part, you've got the altar where you burn the sacrifice and you send it up. So you think about it like a trade. I know it sounds horrible for religious people, but you take your stuff, your potential, and then you give it up to God, and then God comes down, and then your congregation becomes the body of God, right? Not the body of God, but becomes it creates the body of Israel, let's say it that way, okay? So that's the thing that happens, that's the thing that happens in the Jewish temple. Now, one of the things that in Christianity, the weird thing that happens is that the sacrifice and the holy place get collapsed into one thing. And that's the mystery of the cross. That's what I was trying to explain this. I can't explain it, but I was trying to point to you this morning that in some ways, the surprise that we discover in the incarnation is that, like, that which is the sacrifice is the place where the world actually comes together. And that's the mystery. And so what happens in Christianity is that it gets flipped. It takes a while before it happens. The early churches in Rome are still Western-facing, by the way. So if you go to some of the early, like, churches around the time of Constantine and just a little bit after Theodosius, they're still facing west. So the altar is in the west. And then at some point, it flips. And we put the holy place in the east where the altar is. And so the holy place, it becomes the altar, the holy place, all of it gets joined together. So, and that's based on the vision in Revelation. So often you hear people say, why are we still doing this old stuff, you know, from the Old Testament? Why do we still have these forms? That's not what's informing the traditional liturgy. It's Revelation. It's the eschatological vision which is informing. Because in the eschatological vision, it's the Lamb that's the center. And all the angels, everything is turning around the Lamb that's sacrificed. And so that's why the mysterious aspect of the Holy of Holies in Christianity is that it is both the altar and the holy seat. It's all of that collapsed together, but it does have to do with the mystery of self-sacrifice. So there is a relationship between the altar and the tomb. It's not the only relationship, but there is. And that's why in traditional churches, there's a relic under the tomb, under the altar. That's actually what makes an altar consecrated, is that there's a relic of a person who died, a piece of a dead person, underneath the altar. And it's a ritualization of what mystery that Christianity revealed about the nature of reality. And so some of the things that I talked about this morning, you know, it's hard because you can't talk about everything. You just have to kind of find a line and explain it. But it's a very, very deep part of what Christianity brings together. And it's ritually embodied in the way that the altar and the tomb and all of this symbolism from the Old Testament and Revelation gets collapsed into the Christian hierarchy. So hope that helps to understand.
So if you look into, it's called cognitive archaeology. What's interesting, and John Allen talks about this in his book, When you start seeing home, you start seeing the first burials. And burial and home are often overlapping places. And he hypothesizes that the burial is initially understood as the extension of home to these people who are no longer physically present, and that what burial is doing is helping people deal with the grief of having been homed with this individual in a powerful way. So it sounds like there, maybe there's, maybe that condensation that, that you're talking about also is tapping into something very primordial, because there's a deep connection there.
Because something happens in the Christian tradition also, which is very strange, which is that in the Old Testament and in many other cultures, the dead people go outside. Someone dies, take them out of the camp, you bury them outside of the camp. The Christians try to do that, but they can't. They can't do it. People want to bury their dead next to the church. And so even though at first the hierarchy tries to stop it, they can't stop it. People bring, when people die, they like dig a hole next to the church, put their dead next to the church, and then the tradition of the church cemetery comes from that. But that's a very odd thing. A lot of other traditional societies would never have anything like that, you know, where you don't gather the dead together near the holy place. You bring them outside the city. You find a place outside. But it has to do with that mystery about death and home, this image that I tried to bring up this morning, how Christ's tomb is described as the burial chamber, how when Christ dies, at the same moment that he's dying, he's going into the Holy of Holies, right? The veil is ripped. He's collapsing those spaces. It's all collapsing in that moment. So the symbolism of Christianity is deeply embedded in that relationship. Yeah.
I've got a question for John. I took good notes. I thought your talk was great. Scientific worldview is a worldview where we don't belong, and if we don't belong in it, it's not doing attunement for us.
Yes.
When we have worldview attunement, we get affordance and a living continuity. It strikes me as interesting, and I've talked about this a lot in previous videos, this idea of when I use dead reckoning, it's a sense, it's a communal sense we have of sort of like the pollsters do with politics, right track, wrong track. I mean, it's the lowest resolution thing possible. And it strikes me that part of what's going on with this attunement and affordance is that, you know, a big piece of orientation, what we're trying to do is through, I think, symbols and rituals, which seem to be, you know, like you said, even though we have ritual drift, we have a sense in which it's sort of a dead reckoning attempt to navigate. Because time, and especially I think since we've had these massive technological changes over the last 200-300 years, which on one point we have a sense of improvement in life, where generally speaking, living a little older, eating a little better. I mean, it's a tremendously complex question, but it seems through all of this, through the symbolism, through the ritual, and now then the interesting role that science and its wedding to technology have given us, I'd like to hear more about this relationship between science and, let's say, dead reckoning of betterment or loss. Because I think what we tend to see as a society, you know, obviously lately, AI, big anxiety. Is it warranted? Is it not warranted? I mean, this is going to be a major conversation, at least for the next little while. But all of us together are sort of looking at ritual and symbol as these are key for sort of our collective navigation. And science plays a weird part of this because just as you said, we're not a part of it by design.
This is a really good question. And so my typical answer to this takes about 2 hours and I've given it in a couple of talks. let me try my best here. So what I mean by we don't belong, there's one way I talk about that is we don't have a scientific explanation of how we generate scientific explanations. That's a scientific issue. But let me move it onto an ontological issue, which is what I've been focusing on more recently. So the scientific worldview, which is not to be equated with science, right, has generally pushed towards a flat ontology, which is inverted Neoplatonism. It thought it was nominalism, but it's actually inverted Neoplatonism, where only the bottom level is real, and everything above it is progressive illusion as you get farther and farther away from the bottom. So the problem you get with that is, on what basis do you make the claims about the bottom level? I make it on the basis of science. But science doesn't exist at the bottom level, and the scientists don't exist at the bottom level. If that level of human beings generating theory and argument and making measurements is illusory, then it doesn't actually give you any truth about the bottom level. So you need this level to be as real, and there's mathematical proofs, and if you want more on this argument, I've given two talks recently on levels of intelligibility, and this is why I think late Neoplatonism that has reality is simultaneously emerging up and emanating down and is not flat is central. Now, the degree to which we don't pick up on this reorientation of our ontology is the degree to which the vertical dimension that the rituals and symbols are trying to call us to will necessarily fall on deaf ears. Because if there is no way in which our worldview can respectably, right, accommodate, authorize, legitimate the vertical dimension, what is it these symbols are doing? They're just part of an upper level illusion, and whatever they're pointing to is itself. There's nothing there. There's no real call. So I think this is what I meant by, like, when I talk about a worldview reattunement, I mean, the worldview has to change, and we have to change, and we have to get it back. And yes, we need the dead reckoning from the rituals and the symbols, but if you don't have a conformity theory, you need an ontologically deep notion of strong transcendence, in which transcendence is not just psychological improvement, but a disclosure of being and a new capacity for knowing that is not possible at a lower level, right? And so we have to get that back. And it requires us understanding that those truths are only available through transformation, transcendence, but that the ritual symbol side has to have something it conforms to in reality that makes, because if it's not, it's just a metaphor. It's just a metaphor, and there's no strong transcendence there. There's only a weak transcendence of, well, it's sort of psychologically cleaner for me, or it's more effective, or I can communicate better, and blah, 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 blah. But if you want to say, no, 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 right, there is a level of, there's ontological disclosure, and there's a new kind of knowing that is really being afforded by the ritual and the symbol, and you want to, I think both of you want to say that, then the worldview also has to change. So we and the worldview have to change so a real conformity theory is possible so that the vertical is real again.
So I'm wondering, one of the things that I've noticed in terms of scientism especially is one of the ways to break people's one of the ways to get back the necessity for this is to point out to what extent science has been used as a cover for a kind of skewed religious and symbolic world. And that's been happening for several centuries. You know, like social Darwinism is a great example where it's like, this isn't a philosophy, right? This is science, or this is just science. You know, the Marxist had a very similar approach where they said, no, this isn't ideas, this isn't a philosophy, it's just science. But if we can unpack the way in which what they said was science was actually just a form of religious participation that looks a lot more like what we're describing around the campfire, you can help people see the necessity for that that connection to happen. I think a lot of the things that happened during COVID were looked like that. They would tell us exactly, they said exactly that. They said, follow the science. What the hell does that mean? Follow what? What are we following? Follow the science. What are we following? No, we're not, you can't follow science. And so it was a cover for virtues and values and attunement, ways to attune. And so whether it's effective or not, we created all these weird ritual ways to check on each other, to make sure we're all on the same, in the same world, we're all kind of participating in the story. But it was all used with this like in this strange cover of telling us this is just science. We're not. And so this is in ways what I've been saying all along is I don't think the symbolic world ever went away. I think it's still there. It's all there. It's actually just still been happening. And it, even while we're becoming kind of alienated by scientism, it's still there and happening all the time. And that it's not like the step into reconnecting people to it, you know, like I said, it's as close as a family meal. It's as close to them as helping them understand why they like watching a basketball game. You know, it's like there's things that are so close to us that can click you back into, at least maybe not philosophically for most people, but at least existentially to a kind of attunement to what it is that I, why do I do the things I do and why do I care and why would it make sense to participate in rituals and in a, you know, and in a communal way of being. Does that make sense?
I think so. let me try and see how what you said I think connects to what I said.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically, so what we're waking up to in Porti Cogsai is we care about contradictions other than propositional contradictions. And they're just as important. And in fact, a lot of philosophers have been arguing that, especially in the pragmatic tradition, that performative contradiction is a deeper and worse contradiction than propositional contradiction, right? So here's a classic example of a performative contradiction. I am fast asleep right now. I can't be, in order for that statement to be true, I have to be in a state in which I can't make the statement. Mm-hmm. That's a performative contradiction. Right? And I think there has been an ongoing performative contradiction around the flat ontology, which is, no, look, really basic stuff. If I want to measure something, I need this is Smith's argument, I need an entity at a level above the level
measuring.
I'm measuring.
Obviously.
Right, and this is and if you go all the way down Ned Block's, you get down to pure possibility, and then where does actuality come from? Or you get the idea that as you go deeper down, everything becomes indistinguishable, but information in the technical sense is based on difference. There's all of this performative contradiction, and I think things like scientism were a way of trying to, like, you know, Levi-Strauss, and you've got the contradiction, and you try this thing that sort of masks the contradiction. So I think a lot of this was masking performative contradiction with the kind of stuff you're talking about. And I think what you're talking about when you're trying to wake these people up is you're trying to give them a clear instance of a performative contradiction.
Yes.
That then, but you have to do it right because they can compartmentalize because human beings are made, like Eichmann.
Yeah, yeah.
Human beings can compartmentalize in extremely powerful ways.
Yeah.
So you've got to wake them up to a performative contradiction in this that wakes them up to the whole system of performative contradictions.
Yeah, some people, it seems like it's, you know, and you've seen those conversations. Some conversations that I've had where it's just impossible, right? Someone standing, you know, someone that I find is very smart and intelligent, telling you, you know, science is the highest value, and just saying like you can't say that. Like you're invoking hierarchy, a religious image into your description of science, and it's like you could say that, and then it's like, look.
No. But did you just say, did you generate? No. You do this. Did you generate that proposition scientifically? And the answer, if they're honest, is no, I didn't. And if they're dishonest, they'll try and some finagle. And it's clear that they can't make that. There's no scientific process that would lead to that conclusion.
Yeah.
Because like what would you? I ran an experiment on science, and against all the other things, that was the clear independent variable that best explained the. But like it doesn't make any sense.
I want to tweak a little bit your answer to me, because I think when I talk about dead reckoning, it's not use of symbols in a sense. So in many ways, part of what happened in the Enlightenment, and I completely agree with you that a lot of other values were getting smuggled through, but the performative contradictions were used in powerful ways by people like Voltaire to sort of take a look at the symbolic world and say, no, not really. Part of the problem was there were other things going on. And when I look at, I mean, obviously part of how I got into this whole thing was what has gone, what has been called deconstruction, basically people leaving the faith. People generally leave the Christian faith because they bump into a performative contradiction. Yes. And the dissonance is overwhelming, and there needs to be a shift of symbols and identity, and off they go. Part of what we're seeing now, and I think COVID has been a big push for this, is in a sense the unmasking by performative contradiction of a lot of the stuff that you two both have been talking about. That we have we've adopted a new symbolic world where science is the big symbol and it's passed out all over the place, and those are arising, and what people have bumped into are many deeper levels of ritual and symbol that in many ways were relegated as incidental or arbitrary, and now are beginning to emerge as, oh, in my dead reckoning, I'm beginning to notice that for a generation or two, many of the rituals and symbols we have been given up have now fully been lost to us. And other things that very much feed into my dead reckoning of wellness are now beginning to slip. Divorce. Many of the things that you list in your symptomology of the meaning crisis. And we begin to notice that, oh, we threw away these things too hastily, but the performative contradiction done by the Enlightenment cannot be undone. So where does that leave us now? And I actually think that this conversation and a lot of the conversations we've been participating in are a reassessment of both. So science is being recalibrated. It's not going away. And we're not sort of pushing away technology completely. And now there's a new appreciation of, oh, maybe we multi-generationally have discarded these things too quickly. How do we once again have them become deeply formative, not just for me, but for further generations?
Yeah, it's almost like we have this project of integrating science and spirituality.
Yep.
Welcome to our world.
On that note, how do people with a diversity of ideas or experiences participate in a single spiritual home? Or is that not possible?
How do people with what?
A diversity of ideas and experiences participate in a single spiritual home.
Yeah, but that doesn't, it doesn't seem like there's any other way that's the same for a family. It's the same for any group of people that come together with a single purpose, that they all have their own idiosyncrasies. And, you know, that's what, in some ways, what communion is, or what agapic love offers, is the possibility of doing exactly that. Of having a way to be together that doesn't abolish my particularity. And so, and I think that, you know, that's in some ways one of the things that ritualization offers, whether it's ritualization of brushing your teeth, or ritualization of a family meal, or ritualization of communion in a church, that it offers the possibility of multiple idiosyncratic things joining together into one, kind of in some ways, how can I say this, putting together that which we have in common, but then without abolishing that which we don't have in common. There's a limit to that, obviously, right? It's like there's obviously it's a game, it's a dance, you know, and it's true that You know, there are some things which would make you break out of communion as much as your family meal as in a church. But that's, I think that's actually what they're for, right? When you talked about the idea of the campfire and or people going out and coming back, that's exactly what's going on there, because the person is picking berries and the person that's hunting the animal are not having at all the same experience. They're having completely different experiences, but because they know that they have this place of communion where they're going to come together and share their multiplicity, then that diversity actually has value.
And it was also the case that they had starvation at their door that held them together. And part of what happens in modernity and the affluence it has provided us is those containing pressures, when they're off, now suddenly there needs to be a new level of discipline and ritual that contains without the threat. And also the massive pluralization that globalization provided.
But it's I think it's existential suffering which will lead this change. Maybe it will at some point be starving, but at least for now, it is existential suffering. And I think that's what we saw during COVID, and that's why a lot of our churches all of a sudden got filled up after COVID of young people, is because that's what it was. They realized that I might not be physically starving, but I'm dying. I need to come together with others, or else I'm not going to make it through this.
There are different ways, I think, of finding that commonality in that you can all go to the same place where there is already a superimposed ritual structure and liturgy, or you can create a space where you look for the mechanisms and the activities and the styles of being that promote mutual respect and tolerance and acceptance of one another, and especially when you're thinking about a family. I'm thinking about how super important it is to be able, for a period of time in the course of the day or the week, to put screens away, to shut off the televisions, put your phones away. And I mean, I love your image of gathering around the table. I mean, that's a very powerful image for me. But I mean, can you make that a universal rule, or can you make that a kind of a guiding principle for how to restore some kind of connectedness in a family where people are so dispersed or so pulled in different directions by whatever their outside engagement or involvement would be?
You mean the screen? I mean, I don't think you have to make... I mean, the idea that we have to have common attention... That's better than a rule about screens. It's about what the positive aspect. Like, if we're sitting at a table together, then we need to be attending to each other. If we're not, then it breaks communion. So whether it's a screen or whether it's anything else, we need common attention.
I'd like to bring in a different aspect of home we haven't really talked about yet. And I'm curious how all of you would approach this. But there's two aspects that I haven't seen us touch. One is, what do you do about the other groups of people who have homes that threaten your home? We've all kind of talked about, how do you have your own home base? How do you create that community? What does that look like? But what about the fact that there's people that come against you from the outside? That it tends to be a place where there's divergence among people, and that becomes an issue. And what about when you have your own group and there's predators within your group? And how would we maybe think about how we handle those two elements of a spiritual home?
The enemy within.
John's point today, so John often talks about stealing the culture. You inverted Neoplatonism. That's really good. I'm really going to think about that. I think that's a really helpful insight for me to understand some of this long story of modernity. But when I think about how Christians who developed a practice of, in some groups, nonviolence, and how when Christians, in fact, did not have much power within the larger Roman world. This culture as niche construction and creating a movable reins, I mean, that's when you talk about stealing the culture, that's what they did. Now, in many ways, this gets very symbolic. Cultures are only formed usually at the cost of blood. And then the question is, whose blood? And in many ways, Christians stole the culture through their own blood, which of course followed their master who made the move to steal the culture with his own blood. And it's again, part of what I want to continue to make people think now is because I think we've really compressed our we're looking at the now. We talked about that in the room a little bit before in the green room. We need to be thinking massively multi-generational now and see ourselves only as one small segment of much larger identities. And we do that, and we've done that in war. Nationalism in many ways was a modern representation of that, but I think these are the hard questions. And traditionally, Christians have won in culture with blood, but it was often their blood. And that's a very difficult thing for human beings to deal with.
I think that this is tricky to talk about this, obviously, because it has a lot of implications, but there's a sense in which there is the possibility of self-sacrifice in defending your group. That's a real thing, and I think that honestly, often that has to be honored. That is, people that have given their lives to defend their countries from outside invaders. That's something that's happened all through history. I think that actually can be an honorable way, but it's tricky because, you know, guessing the intentions of people and you know, because we're dealing with real political power and we're dealing with violence, it's difficult to discern sometimes the intentions of people who get involved in that, or you know, civilizations that get involved in that. But if we think of it fractally, right, that's how I do it all the time. I try when someone asks a big question like that, like, can you fight off people that attack your country, I bring it all the way down to my level and I ask myself, do I fight off people that try to attack my family? And the answer is yes, of course I do, right? I do it at a small level. I'm not necessarily fighting people off with guns or whatever, but there is a sense in which there are sometimes a need to reject the parasites or reject the people that are trying to take over something or trying to take all the energy away from something, and that is absolutely necessary in groups. Right? And if you run a business, obviously you have to do that. If there's someone in the business that is taking the energy and the money from the business and funneling it towards something else, you have to eject that person. And it's a tricky thing, and it's difficult because it, like I said, it involves all kinds of intentions. But I think, at least in principle, it's something that sometimes has to happen.
Yeah, this the enemies within and the enemies without kind of thing. So we have ways of motivating each other, and that's what it comes down to. And we have basically persuasion, deception, and violence. Those are sort of the three categories by which we can get human beings to do things we want them to do. It was the Socratic-Platonic proposal, that we could increase the reach of persuasion, and we could significantly mitigate deception. And that has to be within self-deception and without at the same time, or it doesn't work. But it was always understood, it's very clear in the Platonic corpus, that no matter how much we expand the persuasion and reduce the deception, there will still be people that will take recourse in violence. And this, of course, shows up in the death of Socrates and the death of Jesus. And I think it's myopic to think that there is a resolution to that problem. Because what would you do? Think about it. What I'll do is I'll force you to be rational. Like, wait, that's undermining the very thing. So rationality, very broadly construed, right, has to by its very nature, make possible violence. Because I would have to resort to violence in order to try and make everybody rational, and that would be a profound performative contradiction. So, if the intent behind the question is how can I get rid of this problem, the answer is you can't. You can't. You're in a trade-off relationship. Now that doesn't mean there isn't practical things that can be done. So the wolf in sheep's clothing kind of thing. I'm working with Taylor and other people in the Verveke Foundation. Because as far as I can still reasonably tell, I really want to do this virtuously. And I've seen fame and, or at least influence or whatever it is, right? And wealth and status and attention, and I can see what it's doing. And trying to figure out best practices. They're not algorithmic because you can't eradicate deception, we can't eradicate violence, but the best practices, I'm not doing this de novo, I'm paying attention to how other institutions have wrestled with these problems, the perennial problems, because we can't make them go away, but we still have to do something about them. And I'm trying to find, with the help of a lot of good people, ways in which the virtuosity doesn't blind me to virtue. And there's a lot of design things you can do. You like set up the foundation to try and get an arm's length distance and have this other entity other than John Verveke. It's funny because I'll be talking about the Verveke Foundation like it's like right. And just a bunch of other things we've put into, it's a dead reckoning thing. We've tried to pay attention to some of the failures that we've seen in the past and think, can we put in, all of this ultimately depends on people's character, right? One of the great failure, and Kafka really made us real, is we thought we could bureaucratize this. We can't. It always depends on people's character. But the idea is, can we put in place practices and governing principles so that people of good character will stay in good character and are making it the case that this is pursued both virtuously and with virtuosity. And then I'm working with other communities. We talk in the Respond Network, we talk a lot about the problem of gurification, like how people become gurus and why this becomes extremely problematic. And what can we do here that will make it less likely that we'll end up there. So I have sort of an answer therefore to the enemy within. The enemy without is the larger and therefore grandiose, and I accept that criticism, but the larger project of trying to not physically but culturally rebuild the Silk Road so that we have the courtyard of dialogos rather than the courtroom of debate. We had all these religions and cultures that had a lingua franca, right, that allowed them to work with each other, trade with each other. They're not just trade stuff, trade ideas in deep and profound ways. And this was a reality, and it joined profoundly different places together, the East and the West. And it worked. It really worked. Now, it doesn't mean that there wasn't warfare or anything like that. I'm not saying that. But it showed that it was possible for people to craft together a lingua philosophica, if you'll allow me, that allowed for real mutual reduction in an antagonistic relationship and a realization of a possibility of a genuine, like I say, a genuine courtyard of dialogos. And so, I mean, the next series is going to be about that project and about what would it look like if we tried. I'm not going to try and rebuild the Silk Road, that's ridiculous. But could we do something like that? It has worked. So saying it's impossible is just false. It has worked. And I plan to try and sort of travel along key points in the Silk Road and talk about key people there. I'll probably get sick. That's part of the journey, hopefully. Right? Because I want to make it attractively possible that we could get something like the Silk Road again, and that would be a way of not removing, because we can't, but at least ameliorating the issue of the enemy without. If we can find the through line between, we reduce the without. I agree with Jonathan, and I keep saying it. These are perennial. We can't remove this, because the attempt to, it's like what's happening in sort of bad versions of the left, right? Where you get into this performative contradiction in which you undermine procedural justice because you're so fanatical about substantive justice. We can't eradicate violence and deception, because to do so would be to be a performative contradiction of rationality. So we can't get rid of them, but I think there are ways within and without that we can significantly ameliorate them. I'm not claiming to have any definitive word on this. All I'm saying is I have made a deep commitment to try and find the best I can within and without, and to share it as best I can.
Well, thank you, everyone.